Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. In communities across America, towns are solving problems every day. Mayors are being creative and resourceful and making life better for citizens. As part of our series of interviews with some of the best mayors in the country, today we have two guests back-to-back. First is the mayor of Newton, Massachusetts, Seti Warren. Following Mayor Warren will be an interview with Stephanie Rawlings Blake, mayor of Baltimore and president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Seti Warren worked as special assistant in the White House Office of Cabinet Affairs for President Clinton, the New England director of FEMA, and deputy state director for Senator Kerry. He also worked with his family-owned business, developing and implementing an award-winning internship program and adult training program. He completed a tour of duty in Iraq as a naval intelligence specialist and then was elected mayor of Newton in 2009 and reelected in 2013. Mayor Seti Warren, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, Eleanor. How are you? It's great to be on. Thank you for having me this afternoon.
Well, I'm so excited about what you're doing there in Newton, and I want more of our listeners to know, and I also want some of the other mayors in the country to know. So I'm eager for you to share the great work you've been doing there. Let's start by how you got to become mayor in the first place. What inspired you to run for office?
Well, thanks, Eleanor. I'm born and raised here in the city of Newton, and I'm so fortunate to live in the house where I grew up with my two children, both 7 and 4, and my wife. And I felt so incredibly lucky because my parents did not grow up here in Newton. They grew up in New York, my dad in the Harlem, my mom in the Bronx, in tough neighborhoods. And needless to say, over the course of a number of years, my dad joined the military to get out of a tough neighborhood. He was in Harlem, and he came back, and he met my mom, and they went down south to college, North Carolina A&T, and they were engaged in the civil rights movement there, and they moved up to Newton for graduate work, and my father was able to purchase the home that I live in today with GI Bill benefits, and really both my parents spent the majority of their lives investing and giving others the same opportunity that they had. They passed that along to me. And as many of your listeners may or may not know, Newton is one of the wealthier communities in the country. It's a suburb of Boston. It's 88,000 people, but we have folks that are struggling. And the issue of our time, in my opinion, is income inequality and economic mobility. It's the ability for that story that I just told you of a family, you know, that grew up in tough neighborhoods, be able to raise their children in a place like Newton and give their kids, myself, and then their grandkids a chance to be economically self-sufficient and contribute back to the community really is the American story. And so I ran for mayor back in 2008 when I got home from my deployment in Iraq because I wanted to ensure Newton invested in the things that mattered, that gave people opportunity for people like me, in education and in infrastructure, public safety, and making sure there was a ladder of opportunity for all people. And so I got elected in 2009, took office in 2010, and we've been off to the races doing a lot of things, and learning from a lot of different communities to create opportunity for people of all backgrounds.
That's a really inspiring story, and I'm so glad that your parents found their way from New York to Boston. I'm hoping you're a Red Sox fan and not a Yankees fan. But
I'm a huge Red Sox fan. I have great
hope
for David
Price. Glad to hear it. I'm
year.
Actually the governor of Red Sox Nation here in Washington, D.C., so good for you. Yeah. Now, as mayor, you've focused on transit-oriented development and smart growth. So tell us what you've done with smart growth, because I think that could be a really helpful model in communities across the country.
Well, one of the things that we realize, and many of my colleagues, including Stephanie Rawlings Blake and others, realize that if we create affordable housing, mixed-use development near good public transportation, we offer access for all people. And what we've been able to do recently is pass a real landmark project here in our community, right in one of our major villages to do that. What we were able to do recently is permit a project that has 65 units of housing, 33% of which are affordable housing, and in addition to that, retail near the commuter rail and bus line here in Newton. So we're modeling that, and we're moving ahead with looking at other specific spaces in Newton, places in Newton, where we can do the same. We're fortunate here in Newton because we do have a number of public transportation stops that other communities don't. But we will ensure that we continue that kind of development here in the city. We're also looking at creative ways to expand transportation options for people of all backgrounds. We know the cost of housing and transportation in the greater Boston region has risen by 28% in the last 3 to 4 years, but yet people's income level has not risen. So we've got to make sure that we make housing affordable and we make transportation accessible and affordable in our area. And I know that many mayors can say the same. And it means investing in infrastructure, and it means investing in expanding mixed-use opportunities like we've done recently here in Newton.
That's a great way to encourage smart growth and not be overwhelmed by the growth is kind of inevitable, but you want to do it in a smart way. And you've done that there. And in the midst of doing that, you've also reduced your city's energy consumption by 26% since 2008, saving $2.5 million in energy costs every year. How did you cut the energy consumption in your town?
I'm so glad you brought that up, Eleanor. So there's two things. I have to credit Governor Patrick and his forward-looking policy around solar and coming up with legislation several years ago that gave the opportunity for communities to create power purchase agreements with solar vendors and the utility to save money on electricity costs. What we've been able to do in Newton is we've ramped that up since I've become mayor and set a goal of reducing energy consumption and costs by 20% in the year 2020 on the municipal end, the residential end, and the business end. We've exceeded and we've gone beyond our target on the municipal end by really moving ahead aggressively using this program in Massachusetts to put solar panels up on our municipal buildings as well as our school buildings. We've also been very aggressive in retrofitting our buildings to save energy and monitor the amount of energy we're using at peak hours. All that combined has helped us save a tremendous amount of money, energy costs and reduce the carbon footprint. One of the things that we're excited about this year, and we're hopeful, by the way, that in Massachusetts, the legislature and the governor maintain the program that's in place for municipalities, and I'm on the forefront of advocating for this with our new governor, Baker, as well as the legislature. If we keep the model we have in place, what Newton hopes to do is something that hasn't been done in many places in the country, and that is to use solar power from our municipal sites and share it with residents, and in fact also share it with low-income residents who need help on their energy bills. We think, and I think, and I announced our community share program, we're moving ahead with it. I believe that we can use this as a tool to reduce energy costs. We know one of the leading causes of foreclosures in the housing market is the erratic behavior of energy costs, and it causes people not to be able to pay their bill because of inclement weather. Severe weather. So if we can bring that cost down for folks who are trying to get by, trying to keep food on the table, folks that are middle class and folks that are at or below the poverty line, that we will be able to create a much more sustainable community and a sustainable environment. So we're really excited about what we've done so far, and we're really excited about the possibility of sharing solar power with people that don't necessarily have the capacity to put solar panel on their roofs because they live in apartment complexes, or their roofs can't support it. and also folks that don't have the wherewithal financially to do it.
Yes, it's been amazing what you've accomplished with that. I think it's a great model, and I love that you're saving the energy. I used to work as a consultant to Boston Edison, helping encourage energy efficiency, and it just amazed me how both the individual residents and the businesses and even the towns would literally have money going out the window because it's just pure waste. So let's tighten up the ship, let's retrofit, let's put in energy-efficient windows, retrofit the building, and we can be comfortable, have the heat we need, reduce our carbon footprint, and save money. So you've done all that, and you've done it in a way that integrates the whole issue about the income inequality that you talked about at the beginning. You're the first mayor I've ever heard talk about sharing the solar power that you get with your low-income residents to help release some of the stress on their financial burden. So job well done there. And the energy savings is part of how you increased Newton's capital reserve from zero to over $18 million. Now, we know there's other communities that have been strapped and going bankrupt and being taken over by the governors, et cetera. But you there in Newton have got your capital reserves from zero to over $18 million. So we know you got some of that through reducing energy waste and saving energy. How did you get to the other part of that $18 million reserve?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. When I took over in 2010, Newton, you know, is known for as being a successful community. We have a strong tax base, but we were really in a financial crisis, and a lot of that had to do with some of the lack of sort of forward-looking on management and looking at what we were spending costs on and not really doing what I call zero-based budgeting and outcome-based budgeting and planning ahead. We worked incredibly hard to, in some cases, make the city much more efficient by using outcomes as a measure for things like how we construct our buildings, how we construct our roads, how we deliver basic services within our community. We saved money there over the course of time, and we started doing some long-term planning on capital. One of the things we were able to do at the end of my term, and we built up the reserves through finding savings through those measures over time. And I attribute a lot of that to the staff and the departments who are able to deliver quality services and measuring those services over time. But what we did do at the end of the, and we raised the reserve fund to zero, to $18 million, as you mentioned, and we protected our AAA bond rating. But one of the things that I do want to say that I think is incredibly important, at the end of my first term, we did ask, and we put on the ballot, and we asked for residents to pay a little bit more money in taxes, property taxes, so that we could invest in education, infrastructure, and public safety. We knew that with all the savings that we had accrued and putting the financial house in order, we needed to address the achievement gap in our classroom. A number of our kids of low income and kids of color weren't doing as well as kids from wealthier households. We knew we needed to provide investment and intervention in those students' programs. And we also needed to repair our roads and our streets and our sidewalks, and we needed to make sure we had the right number of police officers. We passed the ballot initiative to do that. So in addition to creating savings and making sure we're financially sound, we were able to invest in the future. Many communities in Massachusetts don't have the tax base that Newton does, and it would be very difficult for them to unilaterally ask their residents to raise taxes. One of the things that I think states need to look at, as well as the federal government, is looking at progressive ways to invest in education, infrastructure, transportation, to make sure our communities can grow. So not just places like Newton, with myself, who's a forward-looking leader, and others can do it, but other communities across the state that don't have the kind of tax base that Newton does has the chance to do the same. And I think we have an opportunity to do that in Massachusetts in the next few years. I'm hoping the legislature will revise our flat tax here in the state of Massachusetts. We have a roughly 5% flat tax. There's an initiative to make it more progressive so that people making $1 million would pay 4% more, so we can invest in education and transportation and infrastructure in the state that hopefully will be moving forward on a ballot question. So I'm making a, I'm putting out there that though we've done a great work in our cities, we need states, and we also need the federal government to make some investment in cities. Community development block grants at home. I chair the Community Development and Housing Committee for the U.S. Conference of Mayors. We need real partners at the state and local level if all communities are going to thrive as innovative as cities can be.
I think that's well said. And, of course, part of why that referendum passed there in Newton to increase the money for the town on education and public safety and the roads, et cetera, is because you've done such a good job of running the money that they're already paying and running the town. People were willing to put money in. And I think that's generally true. Citizens on the whole don't like paying more taxes, but if they feel like the money's being well spent and it's well managed, they're willing to do it for targeted things like education and safety. So good for you for building on your record there.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, what have you done as mayor to advance women's equality in Newton? There's a lot of different things that kind of come under that, whether it's pre-kindergarten education, after-school child care, hiring women in your administration and in the town jobs. But what's your record so far about what you've done for women in your community?
I'm glad you raised that. And for me, there's nothing more important than ensuring that we have equality between men and women. I have a 7-year-old daughter who I hope that grows up in a world where she's treated equal to men. And so we have to continue to work hard at that, and we have a long way to go. Certainly in my administration, one of the things that over the last few years, my chief of staff and chief financial officer is a woman and has been from day one. My chief administrative officer, the two most senior positions in my administration, is a woman. Maureen Lemieux is my chief of staff and CFO, and my chief administrative officer is Dori Selesnik, Dr. Selesnik, who are just tremendous, extraordinary leaders and help really lead and run the city. 20 out of the 45 positions on our board and commissions are women. My office, all women except for one guy right now in my office. I think that says something about, how incredibly talented women are more than me.
When given a chance.
Yeah, exactly. When given a chance, this is what happens. And if it weren't for the team I have here, I certainly wouldn't be able to have given you the kind of record that I put out that I have. And as far as young women are concerned, one of the things we're doing in our high schools, we have to build an architecture outside of the school system even the playing field for women as well as people of different incomes. So we've done a few things here in Newton to do that, one of which is I created a high school internship program to connect our high school students, underserved high school students, including women, to the knowledge economy, the innovation economy, the STEM economy, and the jobs of the future. We started an internship program 3 years ago. We're going into our fourth year summer internship program. They get a stipend. We have a curriculum. Half of our students, we're now up to, we had 26 students last year. We'll have hopefully 35 to 36 this year, half of which are young women, a lot for first generation students, first generation kids that would go to college. And I could go through some other programming that we have, but for us here in Newton and for me, if we are offering opportunity for all, particularly people who traditionally have not had the opportunity to be in these positions that I've expressed here in the city, and then also get exposure to the current economy that's growing, as a city, we will not have growth, economic growth, and we won't have the kind of opportunity that that's required for our economy in this region. So I think there's an economic imperative as well as really an American and moral imperative. Both go hand in hand to offer opportunity for women as well as people of all backgrounds.
I think that's right. We've got to invest in our people and in our infrastructure to be able to grow here. So
that's right.
You're doing a good job there. By the way, on the women's thing, one recent thing I learned about, I was just invited to speak up in Iceland, and one of the other speakers at the conference was a woman whose job for the country of Iceland is she's in charge of gender budgeting, and they actually do an entire review of the whole budget to see how it impacts women and men. So I talked to her. I said, oh, gosh, maybe we can bring some of that gender budgeting into the U.S. That would be cool.
I think that's a fantastic thought, and I certainly think, you know, at the municipal level and private sector level, state level, federal level, I think that's a great idea. I think that's something that could really bring data into the equation, and certainly we'd be open to doing that as well.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you're the chair of the Community Development and Housing Committee at the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And for our listeners, the Conference of Mayors is where all the mayors get together who have residents of 30,000 citizens or more. And you're a leader there at the Conference of Mayors. What are you doing as chair of the Community Development and Housing Committee?
So there's three things that I've concentrated on since being the chair. First, and I love the Conference of Mayors because we are the voice of cities in Washington, D.C., first, to make sure that our federal partners, whether they be in the Senate or Congress or part of the executive, understand the needs of cities, the resources that we need for folks on the ground. And as my friend Michael Nutter used to often say when he was president and then mayor of Philadelphia, there's no Democratic pothole or Republican pothole. There's just a pothole.
Right.
We need to make sure, regardless of party and background, we are on the ground. We're closest to our citizens. And we need to make sure that we're investing in people and infrastructure and growing our economy and good-paying jobs. And so we need resources to do that, things like community development block grants, one of the most effective programs created by a Republican, Richard Nixon, back in the early 1970s, bipartisan support. We got to make sure that we continue to use that to create affordable housing, to create economic development and investment in jobs and infrastructure. Second, for us, is to advocate policies that promote growth in cities and opportunity in cities. So we have our policies have ranged in support of making sure that we continue to have things like tax-exempt bonding, municipal bonds, that gives us a chance to do the kind of infrastructure work at a lower cost. So we advocate for those types of policies. I have, as certainly the chair and the conference has, as well as other policies that invest in people. And one of the things I did in the last 2 years was adopted and created an economic mobility policy for cities that I based on work from the Brookings Institution as well as Boston College Center for Retirement Research. And that outline really gave Newton over the last 3 or 4 years a focus on the types of programs we should be creating to promote economic mobility, like internship opportunities, investment in children and families, moving them to self-sufficiency. We're modeling a program with the Crittenden Women's Union here to do that here in the Newton area. So we've used that as a guidepost, and I've promoted it with other cities as well, from Boston to Louisville and other places. And third is to share the best practices, things that we're doing that we're successful at, things we have to work on. And we learn a lot from one another. You know, I've learned a lot from my fellow mayors across the country. One of the things I adopted from the city of Philadelphia was our sustainability strategy and reducing costs and thinking about it in a holistic way. And I've worked a lot with Michael Nutter on that. But we really, as a conference, I think, are able to bring those three together: advocacy for funding, which I think we've done successfully in some cases, not as much as we'd like, promotion of certain policies, and certainly sharing best ideas is what we've done with my chairmanship.
Well, you're doing an awesome job both at the Conference of Mayors and in the City of Newton, and I really appreciate you sharing some of your best practices with us here today, and that's all the time we have. Mayor Seti Warren of Newton, Mass., thank you so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you, and please give my colleague Stephanie Rawlings-Blake my best. She's terrific. She's a great leader for us at the conference, and please tell her I said hi.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much,
great.
Mayor Warren.
All right. Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
We will have Baltimore Mayor Rawlings-Blake back after this quick break. See you soon. One of the bright spots in our country today is mayors. Mayors are relatively free of the partisan warfare. Mayors have executive power to get things done, and they use it to solve problems every day. As part of our series on what's working in American cities, we are fortunate to have with us today one of the leading mayors in the country, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake of Baltimore, Maryland. She was first elected to the Baltimore City Council in 1995 at age 25, the youngest person ever elected to the council. She was sworn in as mayor in 2010 and won election in 2011 with 87% of the popular vote. Mayor Rawlings-Blake is also the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, leading the organization for all mayors with 30,000 or more residents. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, welcome to All Together Now.
It is my pleasure to be here with you.
I have so loved watching you in office, and you've been tested by fire and water. And I'm wondering, kind of looking back, you ran for the Baltimore City Council when you were only 25 years old. How did you know so young that you wanted to serve in public office?
So my father was in elected office since I was a child, since I was about in second or third grade. And I grew up watching him impact our community, and I grew up valuing public service. My parents both taught me that that life was about more than what we could buy, and that there was a significant value placed on what you could give. And I knew very early on that I wanted to be a public servant.
That's tremendous. And you've done an amazing job in office. You served on the city council. Now you've been mayor for 6 years. What do you consider your most important achievement as mayor?
I think the thing that I'm most proud of, the thing that I know that will far outlive my time on this earth, is the $1.1 billion in school construction funds that I was able to get for to rebuild Baltimore schools. Baltimore has the oldest schools, the school facilities, buildings in the state of Maryland.
Wow.
You know, I'm almost embarrassed to say how old some of our buildings are, but the conditions in many of our schools are embarrassing. And I knew that we could not convince our young people that education was important and that we valued them and their future if they're going to schools where they can't drink from the water fountains, the ceiling tiles are coming down, in many buildings that you can't see out of the windows because they're fogged. The list goes on and on and on. And I worked very hard over several years to quarterback the effort to bring this $1.1 billion in school construction funds so we can build new schools. And when the governor signed that piece of legislation, that was one of the proudest achievements in my political career.
That's awesome that you did that. It's just education is so much the foundation for everything in your life. You want a job, you want to have a good life, you need a solid education. And good for you for creating the environment to enable the students to learn.
Definitely. My father grew up in public housing in Baltimore City, the first public housing community in the state. And he placed a high value, my parents placed a high value on education. My dad was one of the architects of the city-state partnership that has helped usher in the next generation of Baltimore City schools, where we've seen a tremendous amount of progress in achievement as well as accountability in the school systems with the partnership between the city and the state. So I really consider that the school construction money a continuation of his legacy.
And what a great legacy that is. I just love to see that kind of rising up. I know education was so central in my own life, and I've just seen it for so many people. And you've done so much with your time in office, so much we could talk about. But, you know, talking about the housing, let's stay on that for a minute. When you became mayor, you launched the city's first comprehensive blight elimination plan called the Vacants to Value, which has been recognized by the Clinton Global Initiative and honored by the Financial Times. And as you said in your recent State of City address, quote, working families have become homeowners, artists have affordable units to live and work, and low-income seniors have a place to call home. Tell our listeners about the Vacants to Value program.
I was very blessed to grow up in a solid and strong community. And I know what that did for me, to have a safe community and neighborhood to call home. It broke my heart to see the conditions in which some of our families lived, that there was blight. Decades, generations of neglect and abandonment had impacted so many neighborhoods across our city. And I knew that we could do better. There had been fits and starts for years to try to tackle this problem, what I will say is one of the strengths that I have shown as an elected official, particularly in my role as executive, as mayor of the city, is I'm not looking for partial solutions. You know, I'm looking for ways that we can have comprehensive solutions to some of the city's most intractable problems. So we set out to a goal to create a comprehensive blight elimination plan that worked for Baltimore, that took into consideration the strength that we had in our communities, as well as we were honest with the community about neighborhoods that we knew that were not going to see a level of private investment that we could use to leverage the city investment, and we looked for solutions to those for those communities as well. So I'm very pleased that we've been able to tear down so many vacant homes. We've been able to leverage private investment by strategically demolishing properties and also by strategically enforcing building codes. We forced absentee landlords and speculators to fix up properties that they've been sitting on. We've encouraged private, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in private investment. We created incentives for city employees, for first responders, and for anyone who wants to put down roots in Baltimore. We've created a number of incentives that really make Baltimore affordable for people who are looking to fulfill the American dream. So I was so proud that we've been recognized not just in this country but internationally as a innovative program that is helping to make the lives of the people that we serve better.
Yes, and you've done an amazing job with that, and you've been a leader in the city of Baltimore helping kind of pull the city up and really uplift the neighborhoods, uplift the downtown, uplift the harbor. It's just such a joy to be in Baltimore now. I love to go there and visit to the aquarium with my family. And one of the other aspects that you contributed to the city is that you made it a priority to expand access to healthy food and fight the food deserts that there are in communities that lack access to supermarkets. I believe you're the first mayor in the country to hire a food policy director. What does the food policy director do, and what have you been able to do about expanding access to healthy food?
We know that we can't have healthy communities. We can't focus on the health of our residents if we don't address food deserts. And one of the first things my food policy director did was to do a comprehensive assessment of where the food deserts are in Baltimore. We also worked with our federal partners to to strengthen and enhance the definition of food deserts so they fit with an urban model. It was hard to have a definition of food deserts that didn't acknowledge the realities of city living, and we've worked very hard to bring that issue to light with the Obama administration, and we've worked to close those gaps. We started something here, the first place in the country to have a food delivery service where you could use your EBT card or food stamps. If you go to a national grocer and go online with a national grocer and try to pay with food stamps, you can't. But we created a virtual supermarket program with one of our local grocers that allows customers to put their order in, and we create a point of sale when the groceries are delivered, and it is given access to senior high rises. We have them. We've worked with libraries and some of our social service offices as a point of delivery. So we are closing those gaps, those food accessibility gaps. We've also expanded the purchase power for individuals that are using the food stamps or EBT cards in our food markets. I mean, in our farmers markets. So we double your dollar if you're paying with EBT card up to a certain amount, which encourages individuals to come and use the many farmers markets that we have to get fresh, affordable food year-round.
That's a great contribution to the community there, and it's wonderful that what you've done with bringing fresh food, making it accessible to people and affordable.
And we're not done. We also have a tax credit program that is creating incentives for people to improve their grocery stores in food deserts and also locate grocery stores in food deserts. So I'm excited about what's possible when this legislation is passed.
And you need the state to take action on that?
Yeah, the state passed the legislation, and I'm looking forward to implementing it. Sorry.
Okay, wonderful. So we know that despite all your good work, violence erupted in Baltimore last April, as it did in many cities across the country. You have been courageous and forthright in addressing it, and I believe have said that most of the violence that's happening is young black men attacking other young men. What do you think caused the violence, and what can we do to stop it in Baltimore and elsewhere?
If you're talking about the daily violence that we see on our streets, there's so many causes to that violence. Part of it is this acceptable culture. We see what's unacceptable. When we have a child that's killed in the crossfire, if we see a senior that's killed in the crossfire, if we see someone who has no connection with drugs or gangs get killed in the crossfire, there's a different reaction in our community than when we see young African American men that maybe have a record, you know, that are they've been arrested before, they have ties to either gangs or drugs. Unfortunately, in too many circles in our community, if one of them is killed, there is little concern. And that's heartbreaking to me that the outcry from the community is not they've been far too often they've been silent, and that's why I did the African American men call to action last year. That's why I continue to talk about it as much as possible, that we have to be the ones to value African American young men, whatever their background is, and we show that we value them by stepping up and giving information and getting these individuals off the streets who are carrying guns. Almost all of them are illegal. They don't have any value for their lives or other people in the community, and we have to get them off the street. At the same time, we have to look for opportunities so people don't enter. Enter gangs or enter the drug trade, and you know those both of those things have to happen on a parallel track. But we can't do one without the other. We cannot ignore the fact that there are some people who are too dangerous to be on our streets, and we need to, as a community, say enough is enough.
Right. And do you feel like you've made progress in the past year? It seems like things have calmed down a lot from where they were a year ago.
The thing is, we'd seen a significant amount of progress prior to last year. Under my administration in 2011 and 2014, we saw the lowest and the second lowest number of homicides in about 40 years. To have 2015 follow a year when we had the second lowest number of homicides was heartbreaking because we had seen the progress that we've made. But what I know from talking to other mayors is that they see that with all the work that we've been doing, focused on community policing, focused on reducing excessive force complaints, improving the relationship between the community and the police, focus on reducing violence. If we can have that level of violence with the unrest and the riots and the violent year that followed, if that can happen in Baltimore, we've made so much progress, it can happen anywhere, and it was a wake-up call to mayors across the country.
I think you're right. It can happen anywhere, and I was reading recently that there's some research showing when you have extreme income inequality, that you have social problems, you have higher levels of violence. So I think there can be some deeper trends in our society that go beyond the level of what a mayor can do to the broader levels of the extreme income inequality that we've got now in the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, I certainly agree that we need to do more to close that gap. And to create a pathway for more people to be able to provide for themselves and others. You know, that's the work that we've done. With the DNC. As Democrats, we are focused on creating an America where if you work hard and follow the rules, that you know that you'll have the same access to opportunities that anyone else in our country has, and through the U.S. Conference of Mayors, we're focused on those issues of income inequality and creating pathways for all of us to be able to achieve the American dream. Even if you've made mistakes in your past, if you have a criminal record, it doesn't mean that you're disposable. It means that there are ways that we can look to make you contributing members of our community. I spent the morning with the representatives from the Department of Labor and Department of Energy on the state's first solar job training program focused on those that are hard to employ, that have had barriers to employment. And this program is great because it trains members of our community not for theoretical jobs but for actual jobs that are available in a growing industry. And it also provides wraparound services so we can make sure that the individuals who we're training are actually ready to take on employment and to maintain employment for themselves and for their families.
That's a great program, and that's kind of cutting edge and where the future is heading as we move away from the fossil fuels into the renewable energy. So I'm delighted to see that solar training coming there to Baltimore. We also know that when we strengthen the women, we strengthen the families and the communities. And I was impressed with many of the women in Baltimore kind of stepping it up to bring peace to the communities and do what we need to do to keep the families together and strengthen the community. What have you done for the women of Baltimore, and what do you think more generally mayors can do to advance women's equality?
I think to advance women's equality, we need to have initiatives and priorities that focus on strengthening women, whether it's initiatives like Be More for Healthy Babies, where we've reduced the teen births by, I think, 32%. We've reduced infant mortality by 24% during my time as mayor. When you have a mother that suffers a tragedy of losing an infant, if you have a mother that is too young and it has an unwanted and unplanned pregnancy, you are creating significant barriers when that happens. And for women to reach their true potential. So mm-hmm. we're doing things like that. We're focusing on how do we support women small business owners, women entrepreneurs. What can we do to ensure that they're successful in Baltimore? We have a real focus on those things, and I meet regularly with women in the business community, particularly small businesses, to see how we can work together better to support their progress and their success moving forward.
I think that's great. We just had a guest on this show recently who talked about the gender wage gap, which, of course, we know at every income level, women are still earning less than men, at everything up from some of the fast food working all the way up to, in Hollywood, the multi-million-dollar contract. There's still a wage gap with the gender, but the worst wage gap is with mothers, and that it's a fact now, apparently, that the greatest indicator for a woman being poor is being a mother, which I think is just stunning, that we're not providing enough supports for mothers, whether it be early childhood education or after-school care or the health services that women need for themselves and their families. I think we all need to step it up in terms of helping the mothers be stronger so they can help their families.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a firm believer in the power of Head Start. We have expanded Head Start in Baltimore I don't even know if they call it early Head Start, but it's like ultra-early Head Start when we have mothers that are able to enroll their kids, I think, 2 months, 3 months, so they can really get a head start in life. We have too many mothers that feel like they have to choose between their child's future and their ability to provide for their child. And by expanding Head Start, we are working to create healthy families. I've also expanded the amount of resources that the city invests in out-of-school time or after-school programs every single year I've been mayor, including a big surge last year after the budget had already been expanded. We identified $4.2 million in additional money for out-of-school time programs, with a special focus on finding a way to support those grassroots organizations who have a lot of heart and a lot of credibility in the community, but they may not have the paperwork to enable them to qualify for either federal money, state money, or city money. And we worked with one of our local not-for-profits on capacity building, so those organizations that really had their ear to the ground and had credibility in the neighborhoods that needed them the most, that we could find a way to support them as well.
I think that's just a wonderful way to use the power and resources of government and supporting the grassroots. Like you say, they have credibility in those communities and help them build the capacity so they can do more. I know in Boston, my husband was in charge of helping to award grants to community groups that would do job training. So there was, you know, and African American men learning construction. They had a Hispanic group that was working with the Hispanic women to help them with computer training. And it was really kind of a role where the government would steer but not row, that kind of give the resources and guidance to the community groups that are out there actually and have the credibility and can engage with the people that were trying to uplift the skills.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. And I have seen my role as mayor as a convener to bring people together to think about doing things differently. Under my administration, this is the first time that there's been a task force to take a look at what we can do to improve outcomes for people that are suffering from heroin addiction. Baltimore has had a history for generations of heroin addiction, and no one had thought to bring everyone, community members, service providers, people living with addiction, people who've been successful in recovery, bring everyone to the table to figure out what are those gaps? Why do we still have such intractable problems when it comes to heroin abuse? What can we do differently? And to be a real game changer when it comes to the way that the city creates pathways to recovery for people living with addiction. And we've seen a lot of great progress that has really been embraced by the broader community. The same way with our anchor institutions. Baltimore is known for being a place where we have excellent hospitals and excellent institutions of higher learning. They provide the significant, the bulk of the jobs in the city when they're combined. But no one had ever brought them together to the table to talk about how they can use their purchasing power, their hiring power to strengthen Baltimore's local economy. And we've done that. And that that partnership, that anchor institution partnership is now a model for cities around the country. For me, it's about breaking down silos and thinking about problems and solutions and not necessarily who owns those problems. Now, these are the if these are barriers to Baltimore being where it needs to be, then I feel my role as mayor is to bring people to the table to solve those problems, no matter whose problems they are.
Yes, and you've done a great job of that in Baltimore and bringing people together, addressing all phases of the community there. I'm just wondering, on this whole we talked earlier about violence in the street, what's been your experience about stopping violence against women, whether that be domestic violence or sex trafficking? I know there seems to be a move to train police to deal with the women as victims and not criminals, and providing that kind of surround, all-encompassing services to help the women get back into a straight and healthy life. But what's been your experience with violence against women in Baltimore?
I think we had to have an honest conversation with ourselves about the way that we were dealing with domestic violence and sexual assault. When I first became mayor, it was clear that there was underreporting, and the way that we were handling those cases was not in line with best practices, and we worked to solve the problem. We didn't brush it. I mean, we didn't sweep it under the carpet. We didn't pretend that it wasn't true. We attacked the issue head on, creating a 24-hour hotline for any woman that felt like they had a either domestic violence or sexual assault that was not handled correctly, and set up investigations for that, as well as we created a sexual assault response team to monitor how the city was dealing with sexual assault cases. We also established protocols for around lethality and domestic violence calls, so we could identify women who were at risk of serious injury or death related to their history of domestic violence complaints. So we're using data and we're using technology to track that, to work very hard to address the issues around violence against women, and we're taking it very seriously. As well, we're working to train individuals that are working in industries where there may be women being trafficked, so they can identify those signs, whether it's at restaurants or the casino and things like that. You know, we think it's important that the first responders that work in those areas understand what to look for around human trafficking.
So you've done incredible work as the mayor of Baltimore, and on top of all of that, you are also serving as the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, which is an amazing institution. And what is your top priority as president of the Conference of Mayors?
My top priority in this election year, as the country is focused on who will lead our nation for the next 4 years, is making sure that everyone, regardless of what side of the aisle they sit on, has an agenda for America's cities. More than 80% of the population of this country lives in metro areas. More than almost 90% of the gross national product comes out of metro areas. Whether it's our infrastructure or our public safety, whoever seeks to lead this country needs to understand that cities and urban agenda and metro areas have to be core to the future of our country. We have a platform called Invest and Protect, asking the candidates to be very clear about how they're going to invest in our country's D-plus or D-minus rated infrastructure. We have bridges that are failing. roads that are failing. We have water and wastewater. You just look at what's going on in Flint. We have serious infrastructure issues that are, it's not pork. These are investments that create opportunities for our citizens, but it also creates a more competitive country when we deal with these infrastructure issues as real investments. And we're also asking the candidates to understand that we have to protect cities. And that means looking for stronger partnerships with our federal law enforcement, looking for things like we're doing in Baltimore with our war room that has members of federal law enforcement, state law enforcement, along with city law enforcement, focused on our most violent repeat offenders, looking for ways to replicate what we have in Baltimore with the embedding of federal agents in our investigation team, so we're able to have a better closure rate. We've been able to increase the closure rate significantly this year, and I think it's directly related to the partnerships that we have with our federal law enforcement and with the community, who sees us as active and engaged partners in creating safer communities, and we need to see that on a national level.
That sounds like a great agenda. And have you endorsed a candidate for president?
Well, as DNC secretary, we take a pledge to be neutral until the party has a nominee, and I'm looking forward to that time so I can actively campaign. I'm embarrassed by what I see in the Republican race, and I cannot imagine what would happen with the credibility of our country internationally if any of the candidates on the Republican side would be successful in becoming president. I think it would be an embarrassment and certainly not be the direction that would lead to an increase in our stature around the world.
I think that's exactly right. I was recently invited to Iceland, which, as you know, is number one in the world for gender equality, to speak at a conference up there, and I ended up having dinner with Gro Brundtland, who was the Prime Minister of Norway and started the Brundtland Commission, which started the whole sustainable development concept worldwide. And at dinner, we, of course, were talking politics, and what she said was, you know, what is with America and Donald Trump? I mean, how could Donald Trump be getting any traction in America? So it is embarrassing as an American to have him as the main person in one of our two main parties. So I'm looking forward to the election to make it clear that he does not speak for all Americans or even a majority of Americans.
Yeah, it's definitely. I'm just keeping my fingers crossed, waiting till we have a nominee so I can get going, because I'm very, very concerned about what that would mean to the future of our country.
Absolutely vital. And by the way, when I was in Iceland, I met a woman there. Her job is she runs the gender budgeting for the country of Iceland. I said, what is gender budgeting? She said, they look at the entire budget with an eye towards how does it impact women and men. So I thought, well, let's import this idea into the United States. You know, maybe we could start that with some of the cities.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to talking to you about that in the future.
Yes. You have been through the fire as the mayor of Baltimore and in the leadership role nationally as the president of the Conference of Mayors. What have you learned about leadership that you can share with our listeners?
I've been very glad to have this opportunity to chat with you and, to end on what I think is a powerful note that, you know, I think that leadership is not gender specific. That no matter what gender you are, as a leader, you have a responsibility to give your best and what I believe should be selfless service, to set an example, the example that was set for me by so many women in public service who were poised and graceful and powerful in their advocacy for their community. And I've prided myself on being level-headed, being forthright and decisive, bringing a style of leadership that has helped to usher in a renaissance for my city.
And you've done a great job. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Take care.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.